Hello, plantpreneurs, and welcome to Series 4 of the Plant-Based Business Podcast, brought to you by the team at Vevolution. I'm Eric Amundsen, your co-host and co-founder at Vevolution.
And I'm Damien Clarkson. You will know me from previous seasons if you listened. I'm also going to be co-hosting the occasional episode in Season 4. I'm excited to welcome Eric to the podcast as we expand Vevolution and our reach to listeners around the world.
Over the last year, Vevolution has built the world's leading plant-based and cell ag network and investment marketplace. On the show each week, we explore what it takes to create and scale a plant-based business. We'll interview the best entrepreneurs and investors who are building solutions for a better and kinder world.
Thanks for joining us. Tune in each week to be inspired by entrepreneurial stories, tips for fundraising for your business, state of the industry insights from leading investors, and success stories from Vevolution's new investment marketplace.
Hey, Eric here. Thanks for listening. A quick word from our sponsor, Plant Belly. There are so many vegan grocery products out there nowadays, and it's amazing. But with all these options comes a lot of trial and error to find the best of the best. It happens to all of us. You buy something that ends up being a little disappointing. But what if you could have all the best vegan products put together in one place and shop them easily on your phone or from home? That's where plantbelly.com comes in. It's a new online vegan grocery store that delivers highly curated plant-based foods right to your door. PlantBelly has hands down the best selection of outstanding plant-based foods I've ever seen. I especially love that you can shop by ethos to find brands owned by women or BIPOC makers. I, for example, always search the latest seafood or deli products. It's a great selection. PlantBelly.com is a team of foodies, vegans, and passionate supporters of small batch makers. And they've handpicked only the tastiest plant-based eats to feature on PlantBelly.com. You can use code VEVOLUTION to get 20% off your first order at plantbelly.com. That's VEVOLUTION to get 20% off your first order when you visit plantbelly.com. Now back to the show. Eric Amundsen here, and today I'm joined by Veronica Phil, co-founder and CEO of Grounded Foods Co. Grounded Foods makes dairy alternatives from a novel fermentation process that utilizes imperfect cauliflower and hemp. Hey, Veronica, how's it going?
Great. Lovely to be on this podcast with you, Eric.
So we have something fun for this episode, which I've never done before. So we each have some product here, some cheese-free cheese. And we're going to be doing some cheese shots as we go along. Cheese shot. Should we do one to start before our first question?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right.
Cheers to you.
Yours is filled with vodka as well, right?
Yes, of course. We always start off with this question or something similar along the conversation, but do you always think that you were destined to be an entrepreneur?
I really believe so, purely because, as my husband tells me, my husband is also my co-founder, I'm extremely bossy. And it's impossible for me at this stage to work for anyone else because I think that I know best all of the time. but I think some people are just, they're just cut of the cloth that they have to become entrepreneurs. There's no other way for them. I think for myself and also Sean, my co-founder, we just have this insatiable drive to be successful, to build things. We can't sit still. We don't want to do anything else. We've never wanted to like settle down and have a family. We want to build businesses. That's our baby. It's not even an option for us at this stage. And I think there's a lot of people out there that are like that, but maybe in the past they've kind of lived a more conservative environments and maybe not realized that that was even possible for them.
Yeah, it kind of feels innate. Like it feels normal when you are doing it. You know what I mean? And doing the other thing, you know, I was certainly in the corporate world. I was in the nonprofit world. That did not feel normal. So I think that that's kind of one way to think about it.
I worked in the depths of government policy for 10 years. In my earlier career, I was an economic advisor for the Prime Minister. Amazing job, but I always had other shit going on in the background. Like, I was always moonlighting as a writer, or like writing novels and stuff and getting other, you know, jobs behind the scenes, just because it wasn't enough for me. It wasn't satisfying, that drive to do more and more and more. I have to say that when COVID hit, there were some benefits to that. I felt like with everyone suddenly working at home, my time had finally come. Like, this was amazing. My final form has been normalized and realized at this point. Now everyone is working from home. So I kind of thrived in that environment. And that was when Grounded first started.
I think in general that it kind of does make me curious about your background. So, you know, you have this economics background, like you mentioned, you know, very professional, always other things going on in the background. Your co-founder, Sean, is a restaurateur from Australia. So, like, how did this all start? I mean, from what I remember, you know, from talking to you a few times, it was just him sort of playing around in the restaurant. So what was the origin story? When did this idea of cheese-free cheese start? And what were some of the first, you know, victims of this discovery, if you will?
Yeah, so to give you the background, I was actually running a marketing agency at the time that specialized in natural food and beverage. And that is around the time that I met Sean. We met on a dating app. We met on Tinder. And I guess we're one of those few couples that ended up hitting it off immediately and getting married and working together as well. So we immediately started working on our restaurant together, built that to become one of the most successful fine dining restaurants in Australia, which is no easy feat in the world of fine dining. Very, very difficult lifestyle, very, very thin margins. But we became very successful from it because we were blending both of our skill sets. So he's got extraordinary talent in food R&D and just this gift of making food out of ingredients that people are not expecting and kind of like tricking their minds into tasting things they never thought they would try. And then coming from more of the economic background and consumer psychology, we really built this multi-sensory dining experience, really pushing people's boundaries, like using a lot of technology, 3D printing, augmented reality, with higher sound and lighting engineers, hypnotists, actors, musicians, everything we could to manipulate the dining experience and just completely take people on an otherworldly journey. So over time, like, we had this crazy 16-course blind tasting menu. People would come in, had no idea what they were about to eat. They wouldn't find out what the dishes were until the end of the meal. And part of that was the creativity around, like, removing all preconceptions. Like, we didn't want them to know exactly what they were going to try because we didn't want them to come in with preconceived ideas of, like, oh, I like this, but I don't want to eat that kind of thing. And I admit, it was not a vegan restaurant at all. We would have dishes on the menu that were mainly more focused around upcycling ingredients and low wastage. So Sean would be doing things like a chocolate cake made out of lamb's blood ganache that was blood left over from another dish that he'd served. Or there was a dessert of nougat that was made from upcycled fish scales. So stuff like that. Like, you would never try that if you were told up front what it was. But we did notice over time that more and more diners were coming in asking for allergen-free options. So it was getting really frustrating for the chefs. Every table, every night would have some kind of, you know, request that needed to be catered to, whether it be nut-free, dairy-free, soy-free, lactose-free, vegan, all of these things. And so over time, Sean just started making everything allergen-free and plant-based without telling anyone, just to, like, de-risk the restaurant, not trigger anyone's allergies. But we didn't want anyone to know at the time because it needed to still be extremely creative and still absolutely delicious. Now, I thought that the most boring dish on the menu was the cheese course, the one dish at the end that was just so boring. Like, it was just a plate of camembert, a slice of, like, blue cheese, a wedge of Gruyere. I thought maybe he was doing it just to reintroduce some comfort back into the dining experience, like some level of familiarity. But it all made sense to me when one day he announced that, oh, what do you think about the cheese, by the way, because I've been making it from hemp, there's no dairy in it. And I'm just sitting there like, what the fuck?
Wow.
I was just blown away because I've been eating this for a year. I'd never noticed. And at the time, like, I was a massive cheese addict. I was probably, you know, single-handedly responsible for most of Australia's carbon emissions through my own cheese consumption at the time. And more so, none of our chefs in the kitchen knew. He'd hidden it from everyone, and none of our diners knew. So when you amplify that by the fact that we did 50 diners per night at the restaurant over the course of a whole year, and not one person had ever questioned the cheese course, they just kept eating it, kept ordering it, that was something. And I think coming from that marketing background, I had an acute awareness of other plant-based companies around that time. You know, we'd seen this trajectory of Beyond, Impossible, Oatly, companies like that just start to really soar. But the plant-based cheese category was still so far behind in terms of innovation. Like, everything was still based on just a slab of coconut oil and starch and artificial additives, or at the other end of the spectrum, maybe a nut-based cheese formulation. But there wasn't really anything that was catering to mainstream consumers that were just looking for something delicious or sustainable, a bit better for them, as opposed to dairy. So I'm like, that is a huge white space. I'm going to steal my husband's recipes and commercialize them into a product line. And that's how Grounded Foods was born. I then convinced him to walk away from this career that he'd spent 20 years building, walk away from his restaurant, and let me hire him as my R&D chef. So that's how we started. And within 6 weeks, we met a venture capitalist at a conference. His name was Andrew Ive from Big Idea Ventures. And after a few minutes of, talking with them and meeting the team, we were on our way to New York. That was 7 days later after meeting them. We'd sold everything we owned, picked up our dog, left our jobs and moved to the US to commercialize Grounded. So here we are.
What an epic story. Cheese shot to that one. And this is what we have, you know.
That was at the start of COVID as well. So it was an interesting time to make that journey.
When Sean was creating the product in the restaurant without the knowledge of everyone, essentially, what kind of product was it at the time? Was it a few different products? Was it similar to the product you have now? Was it more of a hard cheese? Was it like a spreadable? Was it like, can you describe that at all? Or is it not that important, and kind of like how things have progressed over the years since then?
No, I think it's very important. We started doing more of the artisan cheeses just because it was a fine dining restaurant. That's what we needed for the menu there. And interestingly, the formulations were very, very different to what we brought into the market in the US, just because the palate is completely different. I think in countries like Australia or places like Europe, it's a very, very different flavor profile that people are looking for. Whereas when we got to the US, we learnt what Velveeta was for the first time, hence why we created this replica that's made out of upcycled cauliflower and hemp and like natural ingredients, not absolute horseshit. this is what he's told me when he first started developing the product and thinking about what base ingredients he'd use. He was researching, seeing that a lot of companies used nuts, and he said, he just thought, why on earth would I use that? That is never going to get the texture and mouthfeel that I would want from a plant-based cheese if we're going to compare it to the texture profile of real dairy. So he said the most obvious solution to him was hemp seed, because the functional fats and proteins contained in hemp are very, very similar to dairy. Not obvious to anyone else in the world at the time that was similar. I think part of it is because hemp was only very recently legalized at that time in 2018 as an industrial food ingredient. So we were very, very early, I guess, to work with it. And just inadvertently, he has now become an expert in hemp foods through no intention of his own, and simply because right place, right time, started working with it really early on.
You know, we'll get to the market in a moment. And I think that what's important to highlight is, you know, you knew you had something, you know, pretty significantly special on your hands. You met who you needed to meet. You made this massive jump to America, became a part of an accelerator. As far as like the accelerator route, why was that a good choice for you? And why or why not may that be a good choice for other, you know, new businesses?
The accelerator did exactly what it needed to for us. It accelerated our business. When we first started, all we had was a concept and I guess a dish that we'd been serving at a restaurant for a year and the idea of a brand around it. But between my co-founder and I, we knew nothing about food manufacturing. We'd never, right. You know, even though we'd had a business together that had done really well, completely different industry in food. We'd never worked with retailers or distributors or co-packers. So there was an awful lot to learn. And what we did want to do was have every tool behind us that we could possibly access, like every resource imaginable to avoid inevitable mistakes. Because you know that every startup is always going to make a lot of mistakes. It's impossible to avoid, but we just wanted to minimize them as much as possible, right? And surround ourselves with very knowledgeable people. So that the first accelerator we did was the Mars Seeds of Change one. We literally got into that the week that I came up with the concept of Grounded. And that gave us... Why are you laughing?
It's just amazing. It's just like, I just love off the cuff and just like how it's, there's just a certain rawness to you and what you've done that just is like, it feels like it just doesn't even feel real talking to you, you know?
It still doesn't feel real to us either. Like when we look back on how we've actually got here, because as founders, we're constantly upset and tortured right. by, you know, all of the myriad of problems with startup life. But every now and then we remember that, like we literally live in Beverly Hills right now. We've come from, you know, a place where we were working in a restaurant in Australia. We had no money to our name. We didn't own the restaurant. We had no savings. We didn't own a house or a car or literally anything. And now we're here. We're right. on the other side of the world.
A lot of people don't even get to that point. I mean, most people can't even get to like from zero to one, right? And you may be at like zero to one, two, three. You might have gone a few steps further, clearly, right? Like who knows what happens at the very end, but like it's so hard, I think, exactly. for entrepreneurs to understand that, like, that just getting to that first like summit is
totally. And I think there was definitely a bit of luck involved. I think it's largely due to a lot of strategic planning. So even though it sounds like we just came out of nowhere and came over here, I mean, I'm all about strategy and business analytics. I'd been working behind the scenes, like watching other companies in this space for a long time and trying to think of a way that I could use my partner's skills for something much, much bigger than just working in a restaurant. So I had this idea percolating for a while on how I was going to do it. But really, the game changer was getting into these accelerator programs. So the first one was Mars. That gave us $40,000 in prize money. So no equity, pure prize money. We used that largely to completely walk away from our jobs and just keep us supported for a couple of months. I also used some of that money to run a patent search on the process that Sean had developed and see if there was anything in the world like it. So that was a really key component to the story for us, because that showed us that there wasn't anything like it yet. And so we knew we needed to double down on that technology. And then the second accelerator was Big Idea Ventures, which, I mean, it was the perfect moment for us. It allowed us to skip the entire step of starting out small, you know, driving around to local restaurants and selling our wares, doing the local farmers markets and all of that. It allowed us just to go immediately from 0 to 10. Like we went from concept to straight into New York, ready to commercialize our products, find co-packer. So that was a huge jump for us. I think it saved us like 2 years in, wow. you know, those early stages of business development. For us, that made absolute sense. Yes, they take a little bit of equity. I think it's completely appropriate, the amount that they take at that stage. I don't suggest that it's right for all companies, because there's some companies that just don't need that. You know, they don't need that aggressive jumpstart to get their business up and running, or it might not even be a company that requires venture capital. Like maybe the founders don't want to go that route. And that's fine as well. Like not every business right. is designed for that. So for us, it made total sense. Got us into our target market from day one.
Well, cheese shot to that. I'm just going to make it really weird and awkward every time, but I think that it's merited.
I don't know. I think a lot of people, I wish I had the courage to do more blind taste tests to my friends, but they would suspect something because I'm doing it to them. They'd be like, what am I eating?
Yeah. We do it all the time to face them.
So what have been some of the main steps? Like, after being a part of the accelerator, kind of building up, you know, your co-manufacturing and building up that process, you know, what is it really like going from that to getting into the getting the product into consumers' hands? Walk me through some of those steps of, I believe it to be, you know, about a year now or so, as far as like, I know that you were direct to consumer for a little while. I remember ordering your box, and then like now you have your some of your retail locations. So like, what does that actually look like? How has that worked for you? And kind of where are you at now with where the product is discovered?
You know, I'm all about honesty, Eric, and it is an absolute nightmare every day. It feels like you're being kicked in the face every single day. It's like, I can't lie about it. It's incredibly difficult. And I think you've got to be built as an entrepreneur to sustain it. Otherwise you just will never fail. Your life will be miserable. You've got to be that kind of weird person that can just keep persevering despite every single challenge that you face every day. It was very, very difficult for us to even find a co-packer. I think it's a similar problem faced by most companies in the plant-based protein or alt protein space, just because a lot of us are working with ingredients, processes, formulations that have never been done before. And so we can't just walk into any turnkey co-packer and get them to make the products for us. They don't have the equipment to do it. They don't have the knowledge or capabilities to do it. And more so, when you say fermentation and startup in the same sentence, they run for the hills. They want nothing to do with you because it's all about business at the end of the day. But co-packers are going to take on sure bets in terms of business, especially now due to all of the issues we're seeing in supply chain and distribution. Co-packers are really locking down. They don't want to take on risky business. They would rather just go with the sure bets right now. So we're very lucky that we even got into a co-packer at all when we first started. It was probably about 6 months of testing in more a pilot manner to make sure or validate that our process would work. Remembering the fact that this was developed by a fine dining chef. So Sean created this world first product on a kitchen bench, managed to scale it single-handedly into a 25,000 foot manufacturing facility with no engineers, no R&D people, no food tech, no assistants at all, just one guy, one little chef from Melbourne. I think that's incredible what he managed to achieve with that. And it goes to show that you don't need a lot of money or, you know, to hire all of these food tech and R&D specialists. You can do it yourself if you have that kind of mindset and skill set to just make it happen. It's just about business strategy at the end of the day and having a very, very unique idea and skill set. I think the next issue then has been working with distributors. Always difficult, especially now, and retailers as well. So, when we first launched into Whole Foods mid last year, it took us a few months to realize that oftentimes, like the products weren't even getting on the shelf. They would just be out in the back room. Or if they did make it onto the shelf, they might not have a price tag on them just because the retailers are so under-resourced and just understaffed that they didn't have the time to do that. So we'd need to send out merchandising teams, like literally just people to drive around and take the products out of the back storeroom and put them on the shelf ourselves. So all stuff that we didn't know when we started. And I think that's part of why accelerators can be really beneficial as well, because that's the kind of stuff that you learn.
Yeah, I see it pretty often where these brands, specifically on LinkedIn or, you know, the more professional communications, are communicating those relationships they need to build in the retail store with either the employees there or to bring in like their own agencies who specifically will go in to bolster the merchandising, to bolster the discovery process, just because, like you said, it's understaffed and it's hard to do. It's hard to make a product stand out.
Yeah. And it's not the retailer's fault. Like, they just don't have the staff in there to be able to get the product onto the shelf a lot of the time. But as a brand, a supplier, you don't necessarily realize that that's happening. You just see the sales figures coming and thinking, hang on, why aren't we selling anything? So it took us a few months to work that out. And then once we did find that out, everything started to pick up from there. So we very quickly grew from like 8 Whole Foods locations to we're now in around 1,000 stores. We're in Sprouts as well, Gelson's, Ralph's, Bristol Farms. A bunch of different retailers, Wegmans this month. So we're really getting very rapid traction. And I think that's particularly exciting just because the category is so flooded that we're still able to get that shelf space because it's very competitive.
What is the current product line? I know that, you know, I've had a few of your products. I guess I'm not 100% sure what is, you know, still available just based off of my own discovery and whatnot. I know that I can get this bad boy down the street, luckily. But what's available in stores versus, like, do you have different products that you do, you know, direct to consumer?
We don't focus much attention on direct to consumer. The channel is there, so people can always order our products online, but we don't do any advertising around it, largely because we get banned a lot of the time. So we can't advertise on Instagram. We gave up on that a long time ago just because they keep flagging us as a drug company. So it's like, all right, you're dead to us, Instagram. We're going on TikTok. And we're now the biggest plant-based cheese company on TikTok in the world. Who knew?
Excellent.
and it's often just stupid content, but it does well. There's no way to explain TikTok. I think because I'm a millennial, I just will, you know, I won't get it, but it's like, it's an opportunity. Let's just stick with it and see what happens. So it's been interesting to be on that platform and see. But to answer your question, we are still selling our first 3 SKUs. So it is the cheese-free cheese squeeze that you've got with you right now, our onion and chive cream cheese, and our hemp seed goat cheese marinated in olive oil with lemon and garlic and thyme. In a couple of weeks, we're about to release this bad boy right here, which is our jalapeno cheese squeeze. Ooh. And an original cream cheese, which, again, we've tweaked the formulations a little bit, now even more protein in them. I think they're even more delicious now. I'm really excited about the original cream cheese as well, because that just, the texture of that is just insane. And then we've got hard cheeses ready to roll as well.
So excited.
Hey everyone, Eric here. Did you know that there's 1.3 billion tons of waste generated each year by the food industry globally? The Plant-Based Business Podcast is created with support from Hira, Europe's fastest growing plant-based meat company. Rooted in activism and the desire to drive positive change, the company's credentialed R&D team, the Tech Rebels, is spearheading a new food frontier that prioritizes sustainability. Going beyond what's been technologically possible to date, Hira's new approach uses nutrient-dense materials from industry, byproduct, and non-utilized plant sources. So imagine, instead of just focusing on proteins from a legume seed, Hira is finding ways to leverage the functionality of whole plants in their naturally occurring structures. Over the past year, Hira has quadrupled the size of its expert R&D team and will launch up to 10 new products this year. Follow Hira Foods, that's H-E-U-R-A, on LinkedIn to see how it's tackling the big, unsolved global food challenges using low carbon footprint technologies. Now back to the show.
One of the things that you've gone through and you've been really honest about, and it's definitely a focus of what Vivolution does, raising funds is only, you know, a portion of what's difficult of running a business. It's, you know, there's certainly not as many, you know, food tech investors as there are SaaS or software investors, right? So we hopefully can find more of them as time goes on. And I certainly see new funds being announced all the time. And I think there's good news there. But what was it like for you? What was the fundraising process like for you? Not only with Vivolution, but just in general, you know, is it Is it something that you wish that you would have done differently? You know, for people who haven't done it before, like, you know, what are some of the best practices? It doesn't even have to be food tech, you know, specific, but certainly in the alt protein industry, it becomes very mission aligned, right? And so therefore, there's just a little bit of a different edge to it. So yeah, I'm just curious, like you've had some unique experiences there and just would love to hear, you know, what has happened. And obviously right now we're going through some interesting times as well.
I think this, again, is one of the areas where I'm really glad we did the accelerator programs, because I needed so much guidance just to explain to me how that process works. I hate not knowing things. I would rather, like, I think with fundraising and VCs, there's so little transparency. It seems like there's rules and secret, you know, formulas of how you're meant to do things and how to proceed. And there's no one that you can ask of, like, should I follow up at this point? You know, how do I translate when they say that they're, you know, not investing in plant-based at the moment? Are they serious, or are they just rejecting me and being polite about it? Like, there's so many questions to be asked. There's no way a founder that's never done it before can kind of navigate that system. So I relied on Big Idea Ventures in that accelerator a lot in our first year, just asking them stupid questions that I couldn't ask anyone else. And when we started this, we didn't even know what a venture capitalist was or did. We had no idea. We didn't know that there were different stages of rounds, that there's seed extension, there's pre-series A, there's series, like, you don't know any of that stuff. So I've definitely learned a lot. I've learned a lot about pitching and refining the pitch. And that's something that just honestly comes down to practice. I remember when I, you know, when the accelerator programs will teach you how to do your 3-minute pitch and get ready for demo day. It's never like that. No. When you actually pitch a real investor, that is nothing like what it's, you know. No, I've never had a real life investor like set up a meeting with me and then expect to see a deck and a slideshow presentation. No, you just chat to them. They're humans. You just tell them the story of how you got here, what you're building, and why you're building it. And I think that was a real game changer. That I wish every entrepreneur understood that going into it. Like, they don't need to freak out about pitching, right? Just have a conversation. What else have I learned? I've learned that VCs are potty mouths in general. They swear a lot, which to an Australian is very comforting. And then I think in the last couple of years, we've definitely found it, you know, this industry has been incredibly buoyant. There's been a lot of money thrown around in this space. It's been very easy to get capital. That has pros and cons. It's meant that for companies like us, we've been able to get to market. Amazing. Like, it's given us the capital we needed to get there. We've done it with very, very tiny resources and a 4-person team. But, you know, that's how we got here. At the other end of the spectrum, it's meant that there's a lot of lower quality products and a lot of companies that are built on a lot of bullshit and unnecessary hype that are also getting ridiculous amounts of funding and really diluting innovation in the space as well. So I think that it's almost a good thing right now that the fundraising environment is kind of tanked, because it's going to weed out a lot of the companies that are not really built on much real innovation or quality product, and leave the space open for the true innovators to rise to the top. Still unpleasant times to go through. This is definitely a bad time for fundraising all around for every company, even the top performers. But it's part of the economic cycle, you know.
What's, you know, are there any other, you said that having a normal conversation, that's one thing I learned as well. I've done some financing, and you do learn that these, you know, investors are fairly normal people for the most part. You mentioned a few other things. Like, is there anything that you wish you would have known before you had started fundraising specifically?
Yeah, I was pretty shocked to find out that stereotype of the way that female entrepreneurs are received holds true. Like, I just hadn't experienced much issues with diversity in the past. I'd always worked you know, I worked in government. I was always around mm-hmm. middle-aged dudes, like middle-aged white guys in government. It never fazed me because it was just totally normal to me that I would be working right alongside them. But once we started the business, it became very blatant and really in my face that female entrepreneurs just do not get treated the same way. And it's made me very, very angry on many an occasion, just because it's completely blatant. I've had heinous things said to me on pitch calls by investors. It happens rarely, but I can't believe that it still happens. I've finished a pitch in the past and the VC that I was speaking to literally said to me, that was a very cute pitch, sweetheart. Now, who actually runs the company though? You're just like, oh, this call is going to end now. Yeah.
I'd love to know who that is offline, but another conversation for another day.
But we've even considered, and I'm glad we've never done this, but privately we've had those conversations between me and my co-founder of like, Sean, should we just put you on the call so that they take us seriously? Like, do you need to do the pitch just so that we get their attention? And I'm sure other female founders have had to actually resort to that in the past.
That's incredible and tragic. I mean, we at Vevolution, I think that about 70% of the companies who have secured funding on our platform are, woman founded or female led teams, which is great. I wish it was more, obviously. I think that even between this past year and the year before, the amount of investment into women led companies has even gone down. I think it was only like 1.9%. And then the following year, it was like still like 1%, even though there was a lot more initiatives and a lot more, you know, press about it. Obviously, like we have the Vegan Woman Summit, who's done so much, you know, for that space. Like, I think that even the reporting is still like, oh, it's still terrible. Like, it's still not changing. Well, kudos to you for you're definitely the type to stick to your guns and be who you are. And I think that's why I get along with you. One thing that's always curious for me as well, I'm kind of going through this. Can you kind of tell us about the current team that you do have? Because it's really lean. I'm kind of surprised. Just curious, like who are the full-time staff that you have? What do they do? And then are you working with any fractional employees or like any other agencies that you have that like you're really glad that they're there and you know you think that other kind of alt protein companies or food companies should consider that path as well? Just curious what the team makeup is like.
Yeah, so I work on business strategy and I'm essentially the marketing director of my company just because that was one area where we can be lean. Like, I used to run a marketing agency. It makes complete sense for me to still work on that side of the business on my own. I have a full-time content creator. So when we started to see TikTok really take off and understood the opportunity there, I hired a content creator to just pump out TikTok videos on a daily basis. And she is amazing. She's completely got the brief. And that to me is now an essential part of my team, just because it sounds silly like that you would have a full-time staff member just to work on TikTok, but that is where the opportunity is right now. So that's where we've invested some of our resources. Sean is full-time on R&D and operations. So again, like we're juggling a lot of, you know, wearing a lot of hats, juggling a lot of roles as a founding team already. It's just necessary in the early days. He would love to not be doing operations, but it just makes the most sense right now. And I think it's a huge benefit to us that we have an internal R&D team. But when you've got one of the co-founders that is the R&D magician, it means we can keep innovating constantly. We never have to spend tens of thousands of dollars on hiring R&D people, getting reformulations done. And it means that we can very rapidly respond to opportunities in the market and start working on it straight away. So that's been something that I think is really, really beneficial to us as well. And then we have a legendary VP of sales, and he is so deeply experienced in the natural retail space. He has worked as a broker, he's worked for other startups, he's worked in retail, he's worked you know, every, you know, in distribution, just at every angle of the entire industry. And we can't live without him. He's completely changed the game for our business and is largely why we've had so much very rapid retail traction in the last 12 months as well. So that's the core team for now. Outside of that, I sometimes use external people. So I run it exactly the same way as I did a marketing agency back in the day, where everyone would be remote and you just kind of get freelancers when you need them. If you need a graphic designer, freelance. Usually we do all, Sean's one of those jack of all trades people where he currently does all of our graphic design, packaging design as well. It's so annoying. He's just good at everything. It's great for as a company, but he annoys me secretly.
Yeah.
So sometimes we'll outsource PR people, stuff like that, but running it really, really lean right now just means that we can keep moving with very, very low overheads, which is particularly important right now since, as you said earlier, so many companies are just having to shed their teams just for the runway.
Right. Runways need to be extended. And when you have the opportunity, when you are ready to do that, whenever it may be, do you have an idea of some of the key people that you would want on your team, like as far as scaling some of that?
Totally. It all comes down to operations for us. And with that, I mean, getting Sean away from the operations side of the business. Like, I don't want him to have to be in the manufacturing facility for a production run watching other things. That is no good use of his time. He needs to be squirreled away in, you know, in a dungeon somewhere, just doing R&D and not being interrupted. That is what he loves doing. That is what he is a genius at. And so it's about just introducing the resources that are going to free up his time at this point.
Is he good at tennis as well? Like, is he good at like literally everything?
Yeah. I was just talking to him on the phone earlier. He was telling me about when he went through Australia's version of culinary school, which goes for 4 years. He did it in 2 years just because he's like, I just did it faster. I couldn't be bothered waiting for everyone else.
Oh, Sean, come on. Making the rest of us look so novice. I'm so excited for the products you've created and, you know, the success that you've pushed with the team. I think that this podcast, we really are trying to provide some value to aspiring entrepreneurs, like people who are in the space, and you've done a good job, some great tidbits and nuggets here and there. Is there anything else? Like, is there any other sort of final advice to maybe an aspiring entrepreneur, maybe someone who's failed and wants to maybe try it again, or just someone who's kind of, you know, I think plant-based businesses we're just really starting, right? And we have now biotech and we have beautiful fermentation processes and all these things sort of taking over. I think for you and me, it probably feels like really crazy. Like, we're in it every day and it feels very intense and we're paying attention to the competition, but really like just the infancy. I think a lot of opportunity still. So yeah, just curious on like your final thoughts and any, you know, words of wisdom to anyone who's looking to, you know, start a plant-based business.
Yeah, it's pretty overwhelming in the early days. If you've never started a business before, like, where do you start? You just have no idea. And that is the huge obstacle. Just getting to point A from zero is the hardest step. And again, I think that's where accelerators can help. I think if it's someone that has failed as an entrepreneur before, like, they're actually the people that don't need a lot of external help. They know what went wrong the first time and how to address it the next time. So they're kind of at an even more advantageous position. I think the thing that I would like to encourage entrepreneurs to do is not listen too much to VCs, because a lot of the time VCs will turn you down because they're looking for like one overarching winner in the category. And we've heard this before in the plant-based cheese space. Many, many times they're like, how are you going to compete with precision fermentation, or how are you going to compete with this or that? It's like, you're absolutely right, Eric. There are so you know, we're in such an early stage and there is so much opportunity for all different ways of manufacturing and creating alternative proteins. Like, there's not going to be just one winner in this space. We need as many companies as possible.
It's us against against the traditional processes. It's us against, you know, the factory farming. It's us against the like 95%+ of like what has already been happening and it was already produced, rather than like, you know, you versus, you know, the plant-based cheese next to you on the shelf. I mean, it's a little bit about that, but in the long run, like, it needs a whole category.
Exactly. We're going to have alternative meats made of all different ingredients, all different processes. There'll be plant-based, there will be precision fermentation, there will be cell-based, and there is space for all of that. So I think it's a bit too early for VCs to start saying, oh, we're looking for the one market leader in the space. Way too early to have that discussion.
Well, a final cheese-free shot for the road. I'm probably going to have some more after this. Any, you know, you said that you have some the jalapeno product and some other products like ready to go. Is there any other kind of tidbits you can drop for us as like what you aspire for like next year and beyond? Like, is there anything else you'd be comfortable kind of sneak peeking for us? Would love to hear what's on the horizon.
We have a pretty extensive roadmap of products that are going to come out in the next 12 months or so. But I do like to stay tight-lipped with it. I don't want our competitors to get a heads up on it.
Fair enough. Veronica, super good to see you. I appreciate your honesty and just like your candid story and unique story. It's so great. I'll be the first one to get the new products when they hit the shelves. Thank you so much for being on the Plant-Based Business Podcast, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hello, Eric here, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Plant-Based Business Podcast brought to you by us here at Vivolution. We're building the world's leading plant-based and cell-ag community and marketplace. Head on over to www.vivolution.com to join our marketplace of investors and startups building solutions for a brighter future. In 2021, more than 25 startups secured partial or full round funding on Vivolution. And if you enjoyed the show, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a positive review. And please consider sharing it on your preferred social media channels. It really helps more people discover the positive stories we're sharing from around the world. Please give us a shout and tag us when you tell others about the podcast. You can find us on all social media channels at Vivolution. And you can email us at hello@vivolution.com if you want to reach out. We love hearing from our listeners. As always, thank you to Bridie Allison Child, who edits the podcast, and all of our guests and you, our listeners, for supporting the show. See you next time.